Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border. Anet here to introduce this special episode coming to you from the Sound Education Conference in Boston. In a couple of seconds, you'll hear Kristaps, but before you do, he asked me to let you know that you can expect the next episode of the Eastern Border in about a week. Okay, happy listening, and see you soon.
Greetings, comrade Duncan. Welcome to the Eastern Border.
Thank you for having
me. We have been wanting. A nice man from the KGB have been very curious about your show since you started touching sensitive subjects which might put the glorious revolution of our motherland under bad light, shall we say. No, actually, really, really glad you're here, and I have to put on my thick Russian accent sometimes because people forget about it, and wow, I'm honored because I started listening to you since the very beginning of the History of Rome days. I was poked at that, and You're one of the inspirations why I'm doing my own show, by the way. You and Mr. Carlin, whom I had the luck and pleasure to meet last year. So it's like meeting a living legend here. And now you're covering a subject that is literally what my whole show is about, telling the story of my people. I personally believe that this is going to be one of the hardest revolution series ever up to date, especially once you get to the Civil War part.
I agree.
So have at it.
Well, there is a reason. Well, I mean, people asked me before I started this revolution, you know, is it going to be as long as the French Revolution? Because I used to say nothing could ever be as long as the French Revolution series, which was 55 episodes. And I think the Russian Revolution is going to blow right past that. Because what are we at? I'm just doing episode 18, I think, this week, and I'm somewhere back in the 1880s, and I'm not planning on rushing this thing at all.
It reminds me, I'm doing my Stalin series now. I'm on episode 19 of that.
Yeah, okay.
Stalin barely just got power in 1935.
Okay, yeah, he's graduated from high school.
Yeah, approximately. No, I understand how these things go, because I made my own Lenin series. Mm-hmm. I didn't focus on the Bakunin part or previous part of that. I just focused on Lenin, which was, you know, when you compare Lenin to Stalin, it's a super fascinating story.
Sure.
Also, you have to mention that poor Lenin was very offended when they stole his cow.
Yes, I promise I will put that anecdote in the show
for
you.
It's a documented one at that.
Sure.
And the problem is, like, obviously it doesn't matter as much as in political views, but there was a running gag through the Soviet Union is that this is why he hated the kulaks so much, because they stole
they
his
stole
cow.
His cow, okay.
But the idea is that he was one of the proponents of the idea that, yes, total starvation, total nihilism, don't feed the peasants, make them do revolution. And when, you know, when I'm going through that, because that revolution also gave birth to my own country. We were parts of Teutonic Order, then parts of Sweden, parts of Poland-Lithuania, parts of France for a bit, had a British governor too at some point. At the climax, at the aftermath of all of this civil massive war, Matt Barron got a special episode on my show, should get a special episode in your show.
He will.
Matt Barron is one of the more interesting figures. Dear listeners, I share this man's appreciation of Talleyrand. Mm. I love him. My dad taught me to love this guy. He's great. With the Revolutions podcast, much more so than with the History of Rome, you touch subjects that are, well, sensitive to a lot of people in the various periods. Like, the French revolutions are very important to people in France. The American Revolution, well, I'm here in Boston and I see American flags everywhere just to remind me that, you know, I'm still here. Same with the Russian Revolution, which is still put under much doubt and very much discussed and even politicized today in Russia. How do you deal with all this? Because you have chosen a subject that's truly, you know, mind-blowing and a bit staggering, and in the sense that you can offend so many people, yet I haven't heard anyone being truly offended about you. Except me for, like, one small period of time about Potemkin's villages. But
right, yeah. Because it is different working in more modern history than Roman history. There's very little to get too upset about when it comes to Roman history. Nobody is, like, the Romans, you know, destroyed. It's not that it doesn't happen, but it was 2,000 years ago. As opposed to, as you say, the French Revolution is still argued about in France to this very day. I mean, there are still royalists kicking out there who think that that the revolution was a bad idea and everything that happened since then has been a giant mistake. There are hardcore Republicans out there who believe exactly the opposite. You know, Robespierre, is he a hero? Is he a villain? This is still very important. These are still important debates that are happening. And then also, as you say, the revolution is in a major way the genesis of what is currently the French national character. So when you are describing the birth process of the French national identity, people are going to have opinions about it, and you do have to treat it a certain way. The same thing happens with the Haitian Revolution. I mean, when you're talking about something that is that important, not just to Haiti, but really to then the entire Caribbean and all of the Americas, and really in terms of global history, having this slave revolt found its own sovereign independent nation and having that be an important thing, not just for those people, but for the whole world. These are still very live wire issues. And my approach to it has always been to treat whatever people I'm dealing with, whatever group or proto nation that then becomes a nation in the process of a revolution, because that's a lot of what this is the birth of new nations, to treat them with empathy, first of all. If not outright sympathy, then at least empathy, and to try to see, I'm always trying to see things from the perspective of the people who did have to live through them. Like, what was it actually like to be a citizen of Caracas in, you know, in 1796 and in 1797? What were they actually fighting for? What were they actually trying to do? What were the subtle distinctions about their culture that made it different from somebody else's culture? What are the things that they can be proud of? What are the things that they swept under the rug that maybe they shouldn't have swept under the rug and you should still talk about because it still has an impact on your life and culture today? I got a lot of, one of the most gratifying things has been when I was going through like the Spanish-American revolutions, that people were emailing me from Venezuela, from Colombia, from Argentina, and they were saying, you know, I went through high school in Venezuela, they taught us the revolution, of course, but they didn't teach us a lot of the stuff that you talked about. In the United States, we have an absolute, I mean, you get it here in Boston a lot of the time. There's an official narrative of these revolutions with heroes and villains, which is fine to celebrate as long as you're also talking about everything else that happened around it.
As long as you're a massive fan of Paul Revere. I have never been so annoyed by Paul Revere in my life.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, of course. Paul Revere is actually a really interesting guy who I think has been let down by the myth-making around
him.
Yes, I think as an individual who lived through a historical period, I think Paul Revere was a pretty interesting dude and deserves more than just being the face on a can of beer. But it comes down to that, is treating with empathy whatever group of people you're approaching. And I think that puts you on pretty solid ground in terms of not just blowing in and saying like, well, this is my opinion about a bunch of stuff that, you know, that I don't know anything about, or I'm going to judge you for doing X, Y, and Z. To try to see it from the Hungarian perspective, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you got to deal with the Hungarian Revolution, try to see it from the Hungarian perspective. And then you talk about the Austrians, you see it from the Austrian perspective. And now you're talking about a clash between two groups of people, the Austrians and the Hungarians, let's say. And if you try to see it from both of their points of view, now you're creating a really interesting historical narrative instead of trying to, you know, even though I obviously, as much as I love Talleyrand, it's pretty clear that I will roll my eyes at Metternich, you know?
Yeah, it's understandable. And that's one of the things that I really like about it, show the empathetic thing, because, you know, as my grandparents lived through that period of time that you talk through now. You're very accurate about a lot of things, but I have to fix it. Potemkin's Village is on air because it may seem like a total forgery. If you look at Pokazuha today,
yes,
then it's like, well, we don't have any documentation from back then, but we can see what they're doing right now when Medvedev is coming to visit. So the Potemkin's villages are maybe not exactly as written, but they're certainly super plausible, and something similar to them was done. Maybe not to that extent.
Right.
That's my thing. But that's a sideshow here.
Okay.
Because my listeners I made a whole episode of Potemkin's villages after that.
But that's what you're here for.
Yeah.
That's your raison
d'etre. That's the thing is, like, I'm a political philosopher by education and a historian. So one thing about revolutions which caught my eye is there's a Russian philosopher called Alexander Pyatigorsky. You should probably read him. He talks about the politicization of society, and he does analysis of revolutions in general. He sees patterns in them.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes that revolutions start when everything becomes politicized. When you either, you know, you dress a certain way, but that is already politics. When you go to the store or not go to the certain store or buy a certain brand of good, that nice. Already becomes a political decision.
The brand wars, yes.
Yeah, brand wars and that stuff. And when that reaches a certain peak, then when everything, every aspect of your life becomes politicized, when politics is the central aspect of all of this, then that's when revolution happens. Now, he also draws some conclusions by studying from both the French revolutions and the Russian revolutions that then it eventually leads to some sort of totalitarianism, which then eventually crumbles down into more moderate democracies. That is his theory, not mine, but Pyatigorsky is not very, very well known outside my region. But as a person who's studied a lot of revolutions by this point, there's this pattern of everything getting politicized, certain problems getting more and more acute, and then Curie point reaching, everything just goes one way or another and it explodes. Then some period of totalitarianism sets in one way or another, like Robespierre or, well, you know, early Bolshevik war economy stuff as well, which he uses examples, and then it kind of mellows down, settles down, and then you get some sort of order. Have you seen this pattern somewhere else? And
usually
a
pretty corrupt
this?
Order is what
yeah,
comes out of that.
That's the thing, corrupt order, but it kind of, you know, mellows order, down.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a volcano.
Yeah, as a corrupt order. I do see various patterns that are common between a lot of these revolutions. I think that the biggest pattern is, even though we have revolutionaries now and professional revolutionaries that are attempting to pull off a revolution, I think that one of the biggest things that seems to be true is that revolutions happen basically at random. You know, you can have the elements in place, but until you get some final synergistic fifth element that gets thrown into it that nobody can really put their finger on, you don't get a revolution. Even if you think you're about to have a revolution, that revolution can go away. And even if you weren't expecting a revolution, the revolution can suddenly happen. These things explode often, seemingly out of nowhere. Or when you're sitting there and you're ready, you're like, here it comes, this is the revolution, the whole thing just fizzles out because the day you were planning your strike or the day you were planning to march on Parliament or on the King, it just rained really heavily that day. And so it didn't happen because people don't stage revolutions in the rain as often as they do in the open heat of summer.
And then I have to raise a glass to Gavrilo Princip and his sandwich, though. When you talk about random things,
yeah.
You know, because I've been to Sarajevo, and he's a revolutionary there. And the scene is there is most of the Western world, but there they have a monument to him in the spot where he shot the Archduke?
Yeah.
Archduke, yeah. That's what's in English. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
it's not my native tongue. Archduke Ferdinand, which is seen as a bizarre occurrence.
I mean, they were doing that. They weren't doing that because they were going to start a giant war, right?
Yeah.
That wasn't the plan. And this is the thing. It's like, even when you have a plan and you go into it and you say, we are revolutionaries. This is what we believe. This is what we are going to try to organize for. And then when the time comes, when we think the moment is right, now we are going to charge in and stage a revolution. I, personally, this is the 10th one that I've done. I have yet to find a revolution where the group that emerges after that revolution, even if they're the same people, that they're up to the same stuff after the revolution that they said they were going to be up to before the revolution. I mean, Robespierre didn't get elected to the Estates General thinking
or
that...
Or was it National Assembly at that point?
No, the Estates General, like when he was elected to the Estates General, like in May of 1789, and they start pushing the envelope with Louis XVI, he didn't think that in a couple of years he was going to be running a dictatorial committee that was, you know, laying down price laws, and that he was going to be ordering executions of people, and that they were going to have to do all this command and control economy stuff. If you look at, in terms of the Russian Revolution, if you look at what, you know, sort of the official line of the Bolsheviks or just the Social Democrats generally was in 1914, 1915, 1916, and then you see the kinds of decisions that they're having to make in 1919 and 1920, you know, they're very different. They have been changed, and because everybody has to respond to events.
But as we both know, those people, all the Dramatists are basically in the Congress of the Dead, as we call them in the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Congress of the Dead is the last Congress before the purges, where basically everyone in that Congress was purged nicely from the next Congress.
Yeah. And one of the organizing principles of them in the early going was that the revolution that they staged was going to be a world revolution. And then all of their philosophy was wrapped up in the idea that this was going to be the vanguard of a world revolution. And all of their theories were contingent upon everybody else joining in the revolution. And then it sort of started getting going in Germany and places after World War One. And then when those were ultimately crushed, then Russia's, the Bolsheviks are sitting there like, well, crap, our entire philosophy was based off of having a world revolution. Now we have to do socialism in one country. I mean, they're improvising on the fly. Like, revolutionaries, it is basically impossible to predict a revolution from happening. And then when the revolution actually gets going, it's nearly impossible to try to maintain anything like fidelity to principle, because you need to make improvised decisions every morning, every afternoon, every night about how you're just going to get through the next 24 hours. And then that's how these things change and morph. And a revolution is a process that no one person really has control over. Everybody is just sort of living through it.
Well, I have made two conclusions, both from your show and from my studies about revolutions. Mm-hmm. The most important are, like, hello kids, you want to make a revolution? Here's how. basically, if you are going to do something, do it all the way. If you do half measures, boom, you're done.
If you want to have a revolution, you need to have a revolution.
Yes, because that is what... What was this guy who won the presidentship in Mexico and then was assassinated?
Madero.
Madero.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm not that educated about that. But first of Madero's example, do not do half measures. Second part is, like, don't jump on the boat in too early. Jump in on the second wave of revolutions.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. You let the first wave go through and knock everybody down. You let one group go through, knock everything down. Yeah. There's a guy named Crane Brinton who was a writer back in the mid-20th century, and he did a book called Anatomy of Revolution, which did compare the English Revolution, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and, of course, the American Revolution. And one of the points that he makes in that, getting to following these waves, is that there's also a very similar pattern of being on the outside of power. You can say and do a bunch of things, and then once you get into power, now you actually, when you get up in the morning, you have correspondence, you have decrees that need to be written, you have orders to do, you have to actually focus on the day-to-day details of running a government. And because that is consuming literally your waking hours, your enemies, your rivals, they're spending all of their waking energy trying to overthrow you. If you're now in the government, if you're like the Girondins, right, let's say, or you're the provisional government in after February 1917,
this is now Losers of Revolutions, the show.
Yeah, you have to focus on actually running a government. You don't have time to also wage this internecine revolutionary squabble among revolutionary factions, mm-hmm. because you've got the business of government to attend to. And you can definitely see this in the French Revolution, where anytime you get into power, you're like, yes, I did it. I've overthrown the people who were doing it all wrong. And then you land, and you're like, okay, what are we going to do? And they say, well, we're still broke. We still can't raise taxes. We're at war with 19 different countries simultaneously. Good luck. And then you're like, well, what do I do? And the next, but during that period, well, you're trying to now figure out these problems that were so insurmountable that they actually led to the complete breakdown and collapse of multiple governments. You can't fight off the people who are coming behind you. So as you say, second wave, maybe even third wave, maybe even just sit back and let the whole thing go. And then when everybody has now you come in and now you're just the corrupt directory, and you can make a fat pile of cash as a director.
Yeah, but like, come in late and take no half measures. That's
right. Come in late, no half measures. That's not bad advice if you want to be a revolutionary.
If you want to be a revolutionary.
I tend to, you know, for having done all of this, I still tend to be, I find revolutions to be a tragedy, not something that anybody should be aiming for.
dude, I understand this, but this is on my show.
Yes.
See, we do super dark humor there.
I just...
It's because we make gulag jokes often because, you know, that's how we deal on the eastern border.
Yeah, and, well, the United States doesn't have gulags. That's a cool thing about the United States is we don't do mass incarceration.
Oh, you don't?
No, we don't. It's
you call them internment camps instead.
No, we don't even call. No, they're temporary housing facilities. And
I'm just kidding.
Yeah,
I'm kidding too.
It's one of the, you know, when it comes to comparing and contrasting free democratic America and evil totalitarian Soviet Union, one of the very first things that will always be brought up is the gulags, right? Oh, yeah. Look, they had gulags, and you're like, you guys do realize we have, like, so many people in prison. We should probably, if we're gonna accuse the Soviets of being horrible totalitarians because of the gulags, we should maybe deal with our own prison.
I think they weren't. The gulags were the least part of all this, actually.
Yeah.
Which is, now I get to the part of the show where I want to explain to you the things that I've noticed so far.
Okay.
Like I said about the Potemkin's village.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have a whole history of pokazuha, of doing things just for show, that Potemkin's village is just, like, that's the beginning of all this. Because in modern-day Russia, a couple of days ago, they literally painted the trees green with paint because Medvedev's going to drive next to it and put, like, nice facades over places. So Potemkin's villages, even if not documented, everyone in Russia will tell you that, nope, real
okay,
thing.
True. Okay.
See, that's the thing. A lot of stuff that happens in Russia is hard to understand. Another thing is that my own country, Latvia, we often forget, we like to pretend that we're very vulnerable and that we were totally conquered by the Soviets. And then they tend to forget that, yeah, Lenin's First Guard were basically Latvian Red Riflemen. And then they tend to forget that in the NKVD, before Stalin's purges, up to 1937, Latvians were the second largest nationality. First one was the Jews, second one was the Latvians. Then Russians were somewhere else. But due to anti-Semitism and xenophobia of Stalin, which is very weird, he basically, well, purged all of them. And Jews were there not because of some conspiracy, just because, well, hey, we want to work for our own country. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, either Zionism or that. So all this national question is super interesting. But the revolution and the things that are happening are going on even to this day. If you think about it, I live in a country whose revolution has, like, been hit a lot, and a lot of people tend to forget how much, you know, in the Baltics it actually hurt us. Because we have a proud history of being anarchists and revolutionaries. Like, if you heard of Ed Leedskalnitz, the guy who built the Coral Castle in Florida.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
There's a massive coral castle, which is like a single dude, 5'3", builds a massive from 2-ton blocks a castle that he moves it around in Florida, and it's been a lot of supernatural shows.
Okay.
He's basically a great craftsman. The problem is he was also a Freemason,
mm-hmm.
a staunch atheist, and a terrorist. Because in 1905, he was one of the guys who shot his local baron, always carried a rifle with him. After that revolution failed, well, uprising failed, he moved to Canada, then through Canada to the United States. He apparently cured his tuberculosis via magnetism, because that's why he's on supernatural shows.
Okay, sure.
But
sure.
He worked in Peter the Painter's gang, if you know who those guys are. Peter the Painter's gang is the reason why United Kingdom's cops carry guns these days. That was a Latvian anarchist gang who robbed banks and sent back money to the Russian Empire for their fellow colleagues to do that. Look up Peter the Painter.
Okay.
He was one of the carpenters there. It's just that he's one of the famous Latvians who did this. And there's a lot of figures from, like, all of our Baltic states and all that stuff, because a lot of people in my country view this revolution, Russian revolution, as a chance of us breaking free and doing stuff. getting our independence, those are nationalistic forces, but there are also the pro-Soviet forces. And that was the biggest mess when I did my Civil War episode. Because you not only have this huge mess in the Russian Empire between, like, class system, mm-hmm. you have, in my case, three different groups of Latvians, the pro-German noble forces mm-hmm. fighting. You have pro-Soviet forces fighting. And you have, like, independent Latvia forces fighting, and that's just in that one territory. Multiply that by the size of the Russian Empire, throw in the Mad Baron in there, which is just, you know, doing his own terror. And, of course, if anyone conquers your territory, they expect a new wave of terror and something, because what I'm saying is that whenever a revolution hits in a sufficiently large country, the rivers of blood that flow are truly, truly crazy, and that is why, like I wrote to you on Twitter, sometimes it's hard for me to make these episodes about tragedy, because, you know, it's my relatives I'm talking mm-hmm. about, and I know relatives who were on all sides, and I'm just wondering how it's like here in the United States. How are you dealing with this? Does it get personal sometimes to you, for your relatives and for your loved ones? As you now live in France, maybe you've encountered some of this.
It is different for me than it is for you on all of those fronts. You know, I am from Seattle, Washington, originally.
Okay. I have actually been there.
That's where I'm from, right?
I've seen Black Hole Sun, mate. And I was called a techie in a dive bar there because I wear a suit.
Yeah, sure. Well, they're... And you have an accent, and so I'm sure they just assume they flew you in to help take over the world. But I think that everything that you're describing, I think, is part of the reason why the American Civil War can still continue to be such a vibrant, contentious event that people are super passionate about talking about. Because I think that people do see their own families being a part of it, both on the North and in the South. Mm-hmm. I think that that feeds a lot of World War II. You know, a lot of the interest in World War II, I think, is for those same reasons, because we all had, our grandparents all fought in that war. Now, for me, my own personal story is that a lot of my background is Cornish miners who came straight to California to do hard rock mining in California, like after the panning for gold part of the gold rush was up, and they needed to do hard rock mining in the later 1900s. Okay, so that's a huge chunk that come just straight to California. Another group comes from Scotland through like British Columbia into the state of Washington. So I'm like this sort of like on this axis between like San Francisco and Seattle, and then that's quote unquote my people. That's like where we're from. So we didn't even really participate in the Civil War. So much of this is academic for me and removed for me. And the closest that I get to a lot of what I have written about is going to, you know, I live in Paris now, and I do walk through the streets.
Oh, where I'm like, so sorry.
You know, I know it's a terrible thing, but when you go, when you know, walking around.
No, that's a European joke about living in Paris.
Hey, Paris is not a bad place to live, especially with kids. But walking around, sure. walking around Montmartre, for example, is for me not just necessarily about it's a nice district to go see music or enjoy cafes. Like I, you know, when you go through the Paris Commune episodes and you know what actually happened on some of these streets and what people are actually going through here, it does have an impact on you personally. But yeah. I do think that being removed a bit from what I'm talking about, I think that is something that is different for us.
That is one of the things, because you know, there's a saying that I heard on, I think it was the podcast that ended, was like, it was about unifying Italy. Mm-hmm. And they said a great saying, I don't know who said it originally, but it was 100 years in Europe is a short time, 100 miles in America is a short way. Basically, 100 miles in the United States is nothing. 100 years in Europe is nothing.
Right, okay.
That's the thing, and that's the attitude. Because in Europe, 100 miles is a very long stretch
of
land.
That is very true.
Meanwhile, 100 years here, you know, I was a tour around Boston here with my own city built in 1201. And I'm like, we have this old church here. And I'm like, yeah, sure, I have breweries that are older than that.
It's true. And, I mean, as, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, it gets to... You know,
but it's not to disrespect anyone. It's just that
no.
it creates a completely different attitude towards life, because on my first trip to the United States, I went here for the last year's segregation, and Boston is still kind of like krieg love zone for Europeans traveling to.
Sure. In terms of European history, so to find those things in the United States of America.
Wait. And then I flew to LA and Seattle, and then it was like, yep, they call this New World for a reason. It is just might as well be Mars to me.
Right. And so to find those ancient things, you have to move off of the very visible European colonial settlement that is the United States of America and move over to the indigenous populations and the Native Americans, because I've even joked about this in the past that, you know, like where I grew up, the oldest building was built in like 1908, and they got it roped off with red velvet ropes. Like, this is the ancient cabin, you know, and it's like from 100 years ago. But on that same spot, you know, the not visible remains, but you can still, these things still exist. These people still exist. Were the people who did live here for tens of thousands, 20,000 years, like, because in Europe, the indigenous and native population emerged and grew out of itself, essentially.
Yeah, like we did in Latvia, yeah. Because we were there before Christianity came to us, before the Northern Crusade.
Exactly.
And we still have our pagan traditions, and the fact that our capital Riga was like founded in 1201 basically means that Bishop Albert during the Northern Crusade just came and said, oh yeah, we're placing the Christian church right here. Not to mention that we've been living there since, I don't know, super long time ago.
Yeah.
We are those, like, native people. Exactly. We just happened to westernize.
Exactly. And there was, I mean, I was in Nice, and, you know, there's a cave in Nice that has been, whatever, occupied by humans off and on for like 500,000 years or something. I'm probably exaggerating that a little bit. But it is something, like, insane. Like, it was a little cave that they come through on an annual migration. And that wasn't allowed to happen in the United States because of European settler colonialism, because Europe projected itself onto this new world, and all of those civilizations that could have then grown up, and you would sit there and you would say, my God, look at this. This goes back 10,000 years or 20,000 years. That was erased. It was truly and almost literally bulldozed.
I kind of don't like the term European being used here because, you know, when the Northern Crusade happened, well, it turns out, well, physically I'm as white as you are, except I have a papal bull from 1189 saying that no, those pagan people in the Baltics, they're actually a different race of people.
Right.
The Pope said so.
Okay, so not European. The group of people who were had been recently conquered by the Castilians, the Dutch, the English.
It's a long story. It's a super complex thing.
Some Parisians and some people hugging the coast of the Atlantic seaboard, who were Breton, but now they're French. You know, okay. But so they're Europe. They're all Europe. Western European.
Europe gets complicated. And yeah. I really, really, that's what I like about your show, because you get, like, really in-depth into this. Before I met both you and Dan, there was, like, this running gag about podcasting community in general, that there are the worshippers of Dan. Praise be to Dan.
Praise be to Dan.
And then there are worshippers of Mike Duncan, and you're kind of the antipode of that. But now, you know, now you've been in the show together, which I listen to, and it's like, a reformation has occurred.
Ah, yeah.
Hegelian dialectics in action.
We've always been cool with each other. We just have different styles.
I know.
It's great.
I know.
And I think we both. He's got a book. I should plug my book, but you know, he's got a book. He's got a book coming out too. Dan does.
That's a spoiler.
Yeah.
He hasn't said about it.
Yeah, it's coming.
Okay,
it's
nice.
It's about the. It's about all the times that Armageddon has happened.
Oh yeah, no, I would so buy that book.
Yeah, it's a cool book. Because, you know, we always, I mean, even the coming climate apocalypse, you know, it's like the end of humanity. Is it gonna be the end of humanity, or is it gonna be just the end of like 99% of humanity and there will still be pockets of humans?
No, we're in Baltics, we're gonna be super cool. Nothing ever happens in the Baltics.
You guys are gonna be fine? Should I move to the Baltics? Is it gonna
pretty much gonna be because great? Nothing ever happens in the Baltics. We have no volcanoes, no nothing. Like, the Baltics are the most boring place ever in history. Except that people tend to forget that, yeah, you can say that Riga was built in 1201, except then you have to forget from the history of Rome part there. Riga holds the entry port to Daugava, and then Daugava, if you go upstream Daugava, then you get to the point like 100 meters from where Venus starts, which takes you to the Black Sea. So Daugava, like, Riga is the entry point where all the Varangian guard
there. exactly.
So we have all the excavations there,
and for one brief little blip in, what is it, 1989, The whole world had to learn that there was a thing called Latvia.
Yeah, because of the Baltic Way,
and,
right?
And Lithuania and Estonia. Yeah. And we had to, like, there's a what now? Because we learned geography on a big map that was red, and everything east of Germany was just
red, and I tried to explain,
and it was so easy, and then it all broke up, and then it got really hard.
No, that's what I'm doing on my show. I'm trying to explain the story of my people.
Yeah,
because unlike you work with historical materials, obviously, mm-hmm. but a lot of my show is, well, I'm more of the Dan school of podcasting. But what I do is I went and interviewed people who were in Afghanistan war. I went to the people who worked with Chernobyl. Mm-hmm. I've gotten the life stories from the people. And my latest episode, like previous one for you, dear listeners of mine, and if you're going to plug this show, hey, check this out. I found a cookbook from 1942 during the Nazi occupation about how wartime kitchen and how to prepare like foods and those things. And you might think it's kind of boring, but when they basically tell you how to make ramen noodle cakes and how to squeeze out the maximum nutrition for the minimum of products, and then other thing kicks in, it's 1942, the Germans are winning the war, so this is the cookbook for the winning side of the war with rationing and everything. And then what kicks in it is that it's actually a reprint of the book printed in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed for practical reasons so that we could survive the collapse. So it goes downhill. But yeah, it's a side note of the fact that that's why we have this terrible dark humor. And, you know, to wrap this up, please, if you can, look at the Odessa jokes, put in some political anecdotes. Because that's one thing that we shared with the Ashkenazi culture and the whole Soviet thing starting from the very beginning is terrible, ridiculous political jokes that helped us through all these dark times. As you said, revolution is a tragedy. And the most popular one is this, like, you know, the Soviet Union is standing in front of a great crevice, but we're going to march forward and take that great leap towards communism.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. I mean, I am actually starting to imagine what it would have been like, because I actually do feel a little, you know, living through, let's say, the Soviet Union had to have been a constant sort of assault on your rational faculties.
And privacy.
Yeah, and just trying to live your life while also being bombarded with something that maybe was not lining up exactly. The minister of whatever is saying something, and you're like, wow, this is complete bullshit, like what this guy is saying. You know, we've always had trouble with, I mean, politicians lie, politicians are dishonest.
But you can't say anything about it.
Right.
And the internal fear atmosphere was the worst, because the KGB agents...
You were stuck, you couldn't even... I can feel these things that are assaulting my psyche on a daily basis right mm-hmm. now in what we now call Trump's America. That at least I can gripe about it on Twitter. I guess that's the
difference. Imagine that if your Twitter followers would then be hired to send the reports there. So that is what I've noticed. Americans are way more extroverted than friendly. We were basically, you know, you can be friendly and nice, but you have to be suspicious towards your neighbors.
Yeah, sure.
And then you use political jokes as a means of testing out who's who.
Really? Okay, sure. Okay.
In the sense that you say a mild political joke and see if they laugh, and then you go a bit further, and then, you know, once you learn...
Next thing you know, you're making Molotov cocktails in the basement together?
Yeah. Like, if you trust them enough. You trust them enough. That's the thing. But I really, really enjoy this atmosphere to bring it out, because I think that out of all the people that could do this, I think you're going to do it right. Because in my show, I've mostly focused on the Baltics in the Lenin's episode and on Lenin himself. And I quote a lot of his speeches, and I went like philosophical, mostly about moons and themes. Because due to my limited resources and the things I had to do at that time, oh boy. Once you get to 1919, then, comrade, just take a vacation. Come to Riga. We'll give you some vodka and take you around. Because I know what's going to happen in 1919.
Yeah, it's going to be a huge mess. And I don't know when I'm ever... I will say this, too. That probably the Russian Revolution will be the last revolution that I do.
Please don't.
Because I don't... I think it's just going to go, and then the show will be over. That's what I think is going to happen.
Well, do you have any plans after that?
Right now, I don't have any specific plans for what happens after the summer of 2020.
Can I give everybody's you one
gonna,
advice?
Everybody's going to pitch me on something, so
no,
let's
no,
hear
no.
it.
My pitch.
Yes, what's your pitch?
The Meiji Restoration. Japan. Instant,
oh, sure.
That stuff.
Sure.
Because, like, okay, Dan did the Supernova of the East about how... And he spoke about, you know... as a side note of his show about, like, and then they westernized in 20 years, got all this packed in. But I feel that you have the competence and the ability to actually do step-by-step, beat-by-beat analysis of, well, westernization of Japan. It is a revolution on its own, of a different kind.
Yeah, I would put it in the category of revolution. I had a starting list of, like, 20 or 25 different things that I would have talked about. Mm-hmm. When I was thinking through it to begin with, and I think that the number is just going to wind up having been 10. 10 is the number of revolutions that I did.
Well, of course, you're not going to cover the Neolithic Revolution, but that's an archaeology joke already.
Well, maybe. You know, I will say before we leave, though, that I was talking people through historical materialism and was talking about the Neolithic Revolution and mentioned as a joke, as an obvious joke, that the ancient aliens taught us how to farm. Like, that's what the Neolithic Revolution was, that we didn't know how to farm, yeah. And the aliens came down and taught us how to farm. And I made that joke because I wanted to move quickly through getting, you know, how did we figure out how to farm, right? Like, that's an entire series. That's an entire series you could talk about what was happening then. So I made this really obvious joke a couple times about how ancient aliens, and I'm getting emails from people. They're like, do you really believe that ancient aliens were here and taught us how to do farm? I'm like, no, I don't. Why do you think I would believe that? I feel like after all of the history of Rome and all of revolutions, that I've earned the right to make jokes about ancient aliens without people thinking that I'm actually being serious.
There's a similar kind of vein of jokes because, you know, Armenian radio jokes were super popular. They were all created in Odessa, which is a special type of place. Mm-hmm. That's the capital of Ashkenazi Jews in Switzerland. And they made Armenian radio jokes. It used to be like a fun radio program. And Armenian radio gets asked in the 50s, is there life on Mars? Armenian radio stumbles for a bit and then answers, well, we don't know. But when we will finally build communism there, there won't be any life there anymore.
all right. Let it go out on that.
Let it go out on that.
Let it go out on that.
Thank you, comrade.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, comrade.
Thank you for listening to The Eastern Border. If you have any comments or specific details you'd like to know, you're welcome to leave it in the comment section on our site, theeasternborder.lv, and we'll rummage even to the western border to find you an answer. Like this podcast? Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or on our RSS feed. Happiness is mandatory. Good reviews and donations feed the farmers of our kolkhoz in the great motherland. The Eastern Border salutes you.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org for more shows like this one. The Dark Myths Void.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.